Welcome, this is William Evans, and you're listening to Shifting Gears. Our guest today is Richard Manning, a journalist with his home in Helena, Montana. He's here in Carbondale today for the Sustainable Settings Harvest Festival. Welcome, Richard.
Oh, thanks, William.
I loved your article, The Trouble with Iowa.
Oh, thanks very much. I've written about Iowa quite often as sort of a negative example of sustainability, of really ground zero of our nation's problems.
Well, and I was particularly taken with the line in your article about the decision to turn off the water intake for the Des Moines water plant.
Well, and that's a fairly common problem throughout the Midwest, and Des Moines happens to be on the leading edge of the problem right now. But basically what's happened is we've so intensified agriculture in the last 10 or 15 years. This is relatively recent in development, especially corn agriculture, which is mostly what's done in Iowa, that the nitrate runoff from fertilizers, chemical fertilizers, is killing our rivers. So we start in the upper Midwest around Des Moines, and the water now won't meet federal drinking water standards. But that's true of everything in the upper Midwest and the whole Mississippi Basin.
And so you pay careful attention to water.
Absolutely. I think that rivers really are a measure of our integrity, that you can tell a whole lot about a given group of humans by looking at their watershed, and the watershed eventually ends up in a river. Everything runs downhill, and that's where our sins tend to accumulate there. So you get a pretty good read on them.
And then our children drink them.
Yeah, absolutely. Aldo Leopold wrote an essay one time called The Round River, and I extrapolated a little bit on it. He actually took that from a Paul Bunyan tale. But I said, well, how would we live differently if our rivers were round? In other words, if everything we put in them came back to us again in a big circle. And that's really what happens. We just don't notice it.
Yeah, we can't see the whole cycle, but it's the real reality.
There is no such place as a way. And once we figure that out, then we probably would live very differently.
So where's your attention drawn to now?
Well, I think a lot about the Midwest, especially just because that's where we're doing the most intensive agriculture. And I think agriculture is really the key to our culture, and it always has been. I mean, civilization runs on agriculture. It really is our largest footprint on the planet. We think a lot now about environmental threats like loss of wilderness and global warming, but those things are also tied to agriculture at the same time. And if you were to poll environmental scientists, in fact, this has been done, and ask them what the worst problems are on the planet, agriculture comes in at the top of the list always.
And there's a physical location your attention about water has gone to.
I follow rivers all over the place, and now I'm working on a piece on Flint, Michigan, which happens to be where I was born, so I know something about the Midwest. And we don't think of the Midwest, especially the Rust Belt, as having an environment. It doesn't have an environment. It destroyed it a long time ago. But in fact, it has rivers, and those rivers tell the same kinds of stories. We've all heard about the fact that a bunch of people have been lead poisoned in Flint, Michigan, as a result of really some bureaucratic malfeasance there more than anything else. But that, too, goes back to the rivers themselves and our attitudes towards them.
And that story in Flint, tell us about how that was broken.
Yeah, that's part of the story of the government intransigence there. So they made a very simple change in their water system, and it should have caused no problems, but in fact it caused huge problems. And residents there started getting literally yellow or brownish tap water. And their kids start getting sick. So there's some cases of children's hair actually falling out, so there were bald-headed kids. They complained very vigorously about that, and this went on for months. It was not a matter of a few weeks. It went on for months, including the state regulators, the Department of Environmental Quality there. And they were told to sit down and shut up, essentially, that they were making this up. There was their imagination. It really was not a problem. A scientist from Virginia Tech named Mark Edwards heard about the problem took a bunch of students from his university or his school there, drove to Flint, Michigan, and tested the water and found out that the residents were, in fact, right. The water was poisoned. Meantime, a pediatrician in a hospital there was noticing elevated lead levels in, or symptoms actually, of lead poisoning in children she was treating, and so started sampling blood routinely of kids coming in, and she found the elevated lead levels as well. And finally, government had to say, yeah, we've been lying about this. That's really what happened.
Is there anything more you want to follow through with on that huge story? And
well, I wish I could tell you the end of the story right now and say, well, as soon as the government got was made aware of the problem, they took the steps to correct it, because it's a really simple problem to correct. I mean, the technology for delivering clean, drinkable water to people has been around for hundreds of years. But in fact, this was discovered basically in October of 2015. I was there doing my investigations in March of 2016 this year, and everybody was saying, well, we'll get the money through Congress now, and we'll take care of this problem. The people of Flint, Michigan, as I speak to you today, are still drinking bottled water that we have not taken care of this problem in a year. So it's not over. It's still going on, and nothing really has changed.
And has anything really changed in Iowa? Because Des Moines had taken their water from that river from the beginning.
Yeah, that's an even more interesting question. So the Clean Water Act of the early 70s, and it was actually 74, but a lot of our critical environmental legislation came around in the early 70s. Clean Water Act said that you really can't pollute streams, and it stops polluters from doing that. There's a glaring exemption in that for agriculture. So farmers can pollute streams. They're allowed to do that under what's called non-point source pollution. There's been a bunch of case history and law and amended regulations and all the time since, but nobody has stopped them from that exemption. And so that exemption still exists, and farmers are allowed to put as much nitrogen in the streams, killing the streams, as allowed. That has not changed. And until we change that law, the problems are going to become more and more egregious. What has happened is that the Des Moines Water Works, the company that really has its water taken away as a result of this pollution, has filed a suit against the farmers who are polluting the rivers, really saying that they can't do this to us. This is our drinking water. What everyone is hoping is that that lawsuit will lead to some break finally in that exemption, and the courts will begin to recognize what Congress should have recognized a long time ago, that pollution is a pollution, and we don't care if it comes from farms or factories, it still kills rivers and people.
And we're in Garfield County right now, where we're running another great experiment with the water supply of the West with fracking. And the exemption that was granted by that.
Yeah, and that's interesting. And also a story that I got heavily involved in just before I did the Iowa story, I did another piece for Harper's Magazine about the Bakken oil field and the development there, which is entirely fracking. And even there, they're not worried so much about water supply. In other words, it rains a lot more there than it does in Colorado, and so it's not supply. But it turns out that to do fracking, the development is so intense and so labor-intensive that it requires enormous amounts of water, but also enormous amounts of labor. And the wells are everywhere in the state. So we've turned that into a national sacrifices zone, looking for more energy. And that's really what we're all about, is energy. I find that really interesting in North Dakota, because at the same time that we lost literally half of a state's environment to hydrofracking, the other half of the state was converted to corn agriculture for exactly the same reason. So about 40% of the U.S. corn crop doesn't go to food now. It goes to ethanol. And the demand for ethanol has started something of a gold rush in the Midwest. So land that was formerly in wildlife habitat, in permanent pasture, in wetlands, has been drained and plowed partly because global warming allows us to grow corn where we couldn't grow it before. But it's been plowed up to grow corn. And that increased corn has gone to ethanol. So all of North Dakota, an entire state roughly the size of Colorado, has been converted in the matter of about 10 years to an energy sacrifice zone as a result of this.
What's your reaction to that as a man watching this happen and having paid attention to water and rivers most of your life?
If I go back and think about the way we thought about what the future and what would happen over the course of, if I go back 20 years and start thinking, say, well, what's going to happen in the next 20 years? And we talked about alternative energy, solar, wind, and we talked about sustainable farming. And those things are indeed happening in our country. People are doing those things. But the big story has been the role of ethanol in our supply and hydrofracking. So we no longer talk about peak oil, for instance, because fracking oil has created a supply of oil that has wiped out the idea of peak oil. We have enough oil to last forever. And that's the big story. It has wiped all those other changes off the board. It has dwarfed everything else we have done. No one thought that possible 20 years ago, that the change would be so sweeping, so radical, and so irreversible. But that's where we are 20 years later, and still talking about global warming as maybe we'll do something about this in the future. But in fact, all of these things are making global warming much worse and doing it so very rapidly.
And nations who lose their water supply don't last very long.
No, and we're rapidly running out of fresh water on the planet. That's a finite supply. Agriculture has used up most of it. It's much worse in areas like Central Asia and Afghanistan, places like that. The Middle East, certainly, the problems are much worse. So it's, I think, no accident whatsoever that the most violent areas on the planet where there's the most upheaval, Afghanistan, the Middle East, happen to be the cradles of agriculture. That's where irrigated agriculture began, in those very places. And over now 4,000 years, we've so depleted those soils and so exhausted the fresh water supplies that that's where it's beginning to come apart. And those battles over fresh water, and they're not explicitly over fresh water now, but they will be, and eventually we will be talking about fresh water as the finite resource, not oil.
This is William Evans. You're listening to Shifting Gears, and I'm talking to Richard Manning about water, the rivers, and the health of our water and our own species. So I pay attention to people who have the clarity and stability to make life-sustaining choices. And I'm interested in your perspective on what happens when the level of confusion gets such that people no longer are able to see and make clear life-sustaining choices.
Yeah, that's such a complex question, and we can go many directions with that and grab onto it from many different angles. And let me throw out a couple of angles that I think need to be talked about. But one is basic and political and kind of on the fundamental level of just our political discourse and where we are with that in this country. And I characterize it, and so do a lot of other people, as a Tower of Babel, that we're in a situation where information no longer matters, and that when we try to insert information into the public discourse, it immediately is ground up and spit back out by a machine that makes gibberish out of everything we say. And the current presidential election is a really good example. And we tend to act as if that is an accident or something that we just found ourselves confronting as being a development that was evolutionary. But in fact, the Tower of Babel that we're on, that kind of confused public discourse, was created by design. And a lot of people work
created by design.
By design. And a lot of people work on it very assiduously. especially the industry, especially agriculture. And agriculture has invested literally billions of dollars into making sure people are constantly confused with studies, conflicting studies, false studies, studies paid for by the corporations. There was a report in the New York Times this week, for instance, about two scientists at Harvard who had been paid off in the 1960s to support the sugar industry. And that it wasn't just two accidental scientists. One of these guys became the USDA's head of nutrition, who had been essentially bought off to say sugar did not cause obesity. And here we are, some 60 years later, fighting that very issue. The reason why confusion is so important to industry is because they need to protect the status quo. And if you look at the nation's midsection, what we call the red states, there's virtually zero governmental regulation in those areas now. And there's zero because of the Tower of Babel, because we are so confused that we have lost our political will. And that is fine with them, because they just need to operate under the current conditions, under the status quo. To do nothing to protect the status, to do nothing is all that is required to protect the status quo. So it's our inability to act that counts for everything for them. It's the default position. They mean to tie us up into knots. They mean to make us into residents of a Tower of Babel so they can continue with their current practices.
I had a conversation one day with Amory Lovins up the valley. And in the course of that visit, he said to me, "We've been long pickled in America by fear." And I said to him, "Manufactured fear." And he said, "Yes, to keep us cowed and stupid."
Yeah, fear is an incredible tool. And if we look at it on just the fundamental level, and people have done this, and just how our brains work, the ways in which we process fear are pretty interesting, because if you're a well-adjusted human and you've gone with the usual pushes and pulls of life, you've learned to modulate your fear. You've learned to control fear and to not go into a panic mode. But if you go into a panic mode, the interesting thing about it is your brain no longer functions rationally. You shut down your prefrontal cortex, literally shut it down, and go into an autopilot. And so if you want to make people irrational, make them afraid. Work hard on that. Make them afraid. And if you look at how much political advertising especially is geared to that these days, you get the idea that people on the other side, the right wing, the rapers and scrapers of the world, really understand this very well. And that's part of keeping us in the Tower of Babel. Make us afraid all the time. Make us worry about crime that's non-existent, for instance, as in the current presidential campaign, or worry about terrorism when, in fact, we're killing more people with our food than we ever did with terrorism. So that's a tool. It's a tool, and it's a tool that's being cynically used by people to protect the status quo.
Tell us some positive outcomes from your writing and your work and what you're watching over the years.
Yeah. I am always struck by how the picture changes when I look at a micro level, when I go into a community and find out how a community actually works and who's doing the good work in communities that are essentially ignored by the national discourse, the national press. I'm struck at how vibrant it tends to be in any community I go into. And that is truer now than it was 15 years ago, 20 years ago. That I think people understand the futility of working on the solutions at a national scale. Because and that's partly because of our national politics, and it's also part of what really counts, is that we understand each other and form relationships, and those can only be done locally. And so once we do that, we begin to affect solutions. And I don't mean that in some pie in the sky, airy fairy kind of way. I mean that as concrete solutions, that people are doing things like sustainable agriculture locally, local markets, farmers markets, alternative education, alternative schools, making solutions happen. And that's true in affluent communities, certainly. We're used to looking at those kind of people put them down as boutique solutions, but it's also true in poor communities. So Flint, Michigan is a very good example that I saw a core of people who almost like pioneers. They're in that community saying, yeah, we're going through some tough times, but we're only going to fix this if we help evolve a local solution. And we're getting better at that. Now, vibrant local organizations that make things work.
Tell us a specific story from Flint that jumps up for you.
Yeah, Flint's an interesting place. It's surrounded by suburbs like a lot of cities are. So it's only the city that's in horrible trouble. And the city itself went from a population of 200,000 to 100,000 over the last 20 years. It's unbelievable to see a place cut in half and abandoned. And as a consequence of that, the only people left are largely African-American and almost all of them poor, desperately, horribly poor people. They're bulldozing 2,500 houses a year there from abandonment so they don't burn down.
Wow.
There are zero grocery stores in the city limits of Flint, Michigan.
Really?
There are no grocery stores, as in chain grocery stores. You can't go to a Kroger. You can't go to anything.
Wow.
Because they no longer exist there. But dead center in downtown Flint, in the core of the city, there is a farmer's market that is as vibrant and as active as any I've ever seen. It would be at home in the most gentrified community in the United States.
All right.
You go in there on a Saturday morning, it is bustling with people who have driven in from the suburbs to buy food, local food, from farmers, and to start rebuilding their community from the center out with a farmer's market.
Rebuilding their community and their health and their life.
All together at the same time.
And what's the action from that level with water?
It's interesting that Farmers Market itself is a half a block from the Flint River. And the entire city is really rebuilding itself from its downtown core, of which that is a part. So is the University of Michigan's Flint campus. So is Kettering College. So is a homeless shelter. A number of institutions like that, but they're all on the river. Every single one of them is right next to the river. And because of the water crisis, they're conscious of the organizing power of that river to make them develop from the core out. They believe that the river is the very heart of their community. And they begin to understand how vital that is, not just to drinkable water, but to a livable community. And it's organizing their revitalization.
So their resilience is directly linked with their water.
That absolutely is. And an awareness of how they're tied to that environment. So the Flint River might be the source of their water problems now, but an organization has also worked on the cleanup of the river. So it's actually quite clean. And one of the first things they did was organized the community into kayaks. So they give kayaks to poor people and also people who just like to use it. They say, get on this river, celebrate it, float it, look at the bird life that's here, that kind of thing, saying, no, we have life in Flint. We don't have to go someplace else for nature as long as we take care of this.
And when I'm paddling in my kayak, I'm paying attention to the water.
Absolutely.
And as a result of the Great Circle, I'm paying attention to the water within myself.
Absolutely. And connecting all those things together and at the same time paying attention to the people who are also in kayaks next to you or along the riverbank, and you understand they're part of that community as well and part of you.
Anything else you want to tell us, Richard?
There's all sorts to say about this, but in the end it ends up being a humbling process to write about these issues. It's almost a privilege to go around and learn these stories. I can sit in the ivory tower someplace and read a lot of books and say, well, I've figured out answers that I can deliver to people. But in fact, I don't deliver any answers to people. I just go see what people are doing and deliver their stories to other people. And it's a privilege to be a part of that process.
And you're getting to watch people take their lives back and their water supply back.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a story that we don't often tell, but it's happening.
I think that's going to be the big story of the transition.
One would hope so.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
This is William Evans. You've been listening to Richard Manning speak about water, Flint, Michigan, and the future of our health. This is KDNK. Thank you for listening.